The Spinoff Podcast Network. Skinny are helping you show how smart you are with the 1Q Quiz, an all-new, super challenging and super quick daily quiz built by The Spinoff. Every Monday, Skinny are giving you the chance to prove you're smart with the Skinny Extra Credit question. Get it right, and you'll get the chance to score yourself some Skinny Extra mobile credit so you can text, call, or even video call your group chat and gloat about how big your brain is. T's and C's apply.
Raising capital or taking your business to the world? Investment Fix has everything you need to make it happen. This season, we're exploring the US market, the opportunities it offers, what it takes to grow a business there, and the best way to approach investors. The Investment Fix podcast. Tune in today.
Namo hi to my tena koutou katoa. Welcome to Podstars with Toby, Annabelle and Ben. This episode is being simulcast across a range of different pod channels, including AltaVista and LiveJournal. We are going to dedicate most of the podcast to Prince Philip, who died.
Yep.
The
45 minutes of silence.
What we'll do is we'll do 45 minutes of silence, but then we'll take them out in the edit. That was good.
Whew.
The Parliament of New Zealand is meeting today on Tuesday the
13th?
Tuesday the 13th of April.
Tuesday the 13th.
That's the fateful Tuesday the 13th.
An inauspicious day, the Ides. Is it the Ides?
Is it?
The 15th.
Right
in.
I have no idea what we're talking about.
It's Ben's classical background. He loves a bit of Ides. The elected parliamentarians of New Zealand a gathering today on Tuesday the 13th of April, this afternoon, for a normal sitting day of Parliament. And then they're going to do tributes to the Duke of Edinburgh.
Respectful vibes.
And then they're going to go for the day, which I thought is like, I mean, cool. Like, I mean, good, do the tributes. But then they're just packing up and leaving. Like, I don't know, are they going to go home and watch royal documentaries all day or what? Maybe they could just go and then come back again and start over. It just seems like a bit of a waste of a sitting day.
Just a quiet period of mourning for them, maybe.
I feel like the only apt tribute would be to do a really long general debate, just full of zingers.
Full of gaffes. That would be, and you get extra points for, you know, allusions to some of old dukies.
You say gaffes, I say confirmed kills. Mm. Like, Prince Philip would have been an amazing tweeter in the 1950s.
Oh, my God.
He would have been just the apex poster.
Handsome or not handsome?
I think he was quite a good-looking man by royal standards. The funny thing is that on Friday night, so I watched the first series of The Crown when it first came out, and then once I realised John Lithgow wasn't going to be in the second series, I didn't bother with the second series. Mm. But on Friday night, I was like, I'll have a look, started watching, loved it, and I was three episodes in, and news alert comes through.
Wow.
So I basically killed Philip just with my viewing.
With your remote.
Yeah.
Amazing, the powers.
Mm.
The
he's a field admiral in the New Zealand Navy.
Yeah, they've all got bits and stripes and lapels and whatnot.
I don't know how much use he would have been. He was apparently very good in the Second World War in a naval battle near Sicily. Naval,
yeah,
saved a lot of lives with some cunning smokescreen diversion kind of tactic. It's pretty interesting. He was good looking when he was young. He was a bit rough towards the end.
Well,
but I mean, but time hasn't been kind to any of us.
To be fair, he was 99.
Right. That's right. Well, I think we've covered off the tributes to Duke of Edinburgh there. We'll do another 10 minutes of silence. I suppose the major political news line of recent times was the decision to place a temporary halt, a suspension, temporary ban, call it what you like, on all arrivals from India after there'd been a kind of marked spike in COVID cases in India, especially in Mumbai. And the decision was unprecedented, particularly because it meant that that included New Zealand citizens and residents, and there were questions about how that sat within the law, and it needed to be, you know, justified, seems to be the whatever that means. Big step, caused some concerns and ructions, including from some members of the Indian community in New Zealand. How did you think that one landed, Annabel Lee Mather?
Well, as the medical expert interviewed on RNZ said, it wasn't so much that it was a spike, but a constant increase of infected people arriving, and that's due to obviously the size of the population and all of that sort of stuff. Obviously, a decision like that is never going to go down well with the communities that it affects, and it's obviously going to put a lot of whānau into difficult positions, but, you know, these are unprecedented times, so I understood why the decision was taken to put a temporary ban, because the reality is, I mean, as we've seen in the last couple of days, when our MIQs are overwhelmed with infectious people, it starts to seep out into the community.
The decision applies as of Sunday and through until, I think, the end of April, April 29, Ben Thomas. And the case that was made was that this was buying some time to look at options and ways to better manage those increased number of cases coming from a particular place. So it's crucial, isn't it, that on... I mean, it will be a crucial moment on April 29 or ahead of that, whether they have come up with a solution or whether they just go, we're just going to add another 4 weeks to it, at which point it starts moving away from this temporary suspension into something more substantial.
Yeah, the debates about the legalities, I think, are probably the least interesting part of that announcement. I mean, a sovereign nation has the right to control its borders. There's no question about that. In terms of whether it's a justified limitation, you know, sure, legally, there was a bit of a discussion about, you know, was the sort of decision motivated by racism? It was obviously a decision motivated by keeping numbers of infected people in MIQ down. I think it was certainly an easier decision to make for the Prime Minister politically, because it was India and not the UK or the United States. We've heard about, you know, India has the vast majority of cases that are now coming into MIQ. I think the same was probably true of the United States and the United Kingdom once you put them together at the beginning of the pandemic. I don't know that there was as high a rate of infection of people coming through, you know, as in the sort of
the positive case number wasn't as high, but yeah, it's comparable for sure.
Yeah, but I think that what you're talking about in terms of that 2 weeks is really the crucial issue here, which is that that's the crucial issue in terms of the government sort of delivering on this policy, because as we've seen in our highly iterative and ultimately largely successful response at the border, is that the government often wastes a lot of time and says that it's going to do things like test frontline border workers, implement regular testing, vaccinate border workers, which it ends up just not doing until there's another failure, and then we learn about it and then more pressure goes on. So I think, you know, it obviously will really depend on whether the government does take this time to actually put in place steps like, you know, MIQ over in India so that people have 2 weeks clear before they get on a plane. That seems to be the big problem, that moving through India to get to your plane is highly hazardous in the current circumstances.
I mean, Susie Wiles made an interesting point or offered a hypothesis in a piece for us in which she said it could be that the paradox is that people going to get the pre-departure test may expose the people to the virus, you know, the pre-departure test, of course, designed to prevent exactly what's happening, but could end up backfiring.
I mean, there's another question, which is, you know, what is our ultimate aim with the border? Is it to only select the best and most uninfected people to come back to New Zealand, or is it to help New Zealanders get away from these COVID-infested health sites?
Yeah.
And you know, depending on where you put the balance in terms of priorities, that'll dictate, you know, if the idea is just to select the best people to come back here who are at least likely to infect us, then we'd close off way more than just
India. Exactly. And I mean, if you don't have, if you aren't a New Zealand citizen or resident or family member or have had a very high bar of other qualifying criteria, then you're not coming from anywhere. So these aren't, you know, you're absolutely right that they need to find a solution to it, because, I mean, even though you say that you're not excited by the legal issue, there is a kind of part of that legal framework is that we allow New Zealanders to return to their home.
But even more than the legalities, you know, this is New Zealanders' home. And one of, I think we've gotten off remarkably lightly in terms of in terms of the pandemic itself, in terms of the COVID ravaging the country. We basically escaped scot-free on that. Not clear what the long-term effects will be in terms of, you know, mental health, loss of education time, but probably, you know, we would hope not too bad, because we didn't have particularly long lockdowns here, unlike overseas. And the economic fallout, bad, but nowhere near as bad as expected. But what has happened is that something about the New Zealand national character seems to have changed a little, which is we have become much, much more inward-looking, much more fearful. You know, xenophobia obviously is a sort of staple of the New Zealand kind of psyche. But this idea of turning on New Zealanders who are overseas simply because they're not within our borders at, you know, the current time, which you see not just in terms of, you know, New Zealanders over in India, but, you know, even people coming back from the US or the UK, is really unsettling, I think.
I'm not sure if I entirely agree with that. And I think that, you know, part of the consideration, well, one of the issues that we need to consider as part of this is that actually New Zealand is punching well above our weight in terms of the amount of people that we have coming through our MIQs per capita. I think we're 5 times more than Australia. And so putting some filters in place to keep it safe is not a horrendous breach of people's human rights. But more importantly, those people that work at our borders and in our MIQs, we know a lot of them are low paid, many of them on minimum wage, which also means that they're more than likely and living in homes where they're having to share with a large number of other family members. They might have limited access to medical support and facilities, all of those sorts of things. So the people who are caring for people with COVID or are brushing up against them are some of our, a number of them are quite vulnerable, and we actually have to think about making sure that their workplace is as safe as possible as it possibly can be while a pandemic rages around the world. So I think that actually putting some limits in place to stem the flow of people in, so that they we don't infect New Zealanders who are resident here, is actually not an unreasonable expectation. In terms of India, and would it have been, you know, is it more palatable because it's India and not America? I would argue that we actually have really different relationships with those countries. You don't have a huge amount of, you know, New Zealanders coming back from India, or, you know, dual citizenship situations. We do have a lot of dual citizenships or you know, flow in and out of New Zealand and India. So I actually think it would have been a more difficult decision, but I think it's the right one in terms of at least trying to figure out what we can do better to bring people home safely.
One of the changes to that MIQ system that's been introduced, which I think happened since we last podded, was the announcement of the Trans-Tasman bubble, which will open on April 19. And one of the flow-on effects of that is that we'll do our next podcast from Sydney, I assume, but one of the flow-on effects from that is that that creates this extra capacity in the system, which is a good thing, but also part of the acknowledgement of that was that they were likely to decommission various of the facilities. And I actually have a friend who is currently in the Hamilton Ibis, which is a flight, and the entire hotel, she's loving it. It's got a view of the Waikato, Tainui Run, magnificent.
That's a beautiful hotel.
But it has no, the windows don't open. There's like the there's almost no ventilation. And it seems like, to me, non-expert, the kind of hotel that they are basically going to decommission, likely to decommission.
Great wine list.
Great wine list. She's having a nice time.
Slacks, but, all of that.
But you know what I mean. Like, and which means, you know, Hipkins acknowledges that there's some that they think maybe not be quite right for the higher risk. And you're kind of like, so basically, a whole lot of hotels are being run for where they know that nobody's got COVID because they've all come from a flight from Sydney.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
It's sort of weird, you know.
The travel bubble is ludicrously overdue. There's no particular reason that it's safer now than it was in November.
The other thing that we want to get onto is the case, which I think we've touched on maybe in passing, is this the Grand Millennium Hotel security guard, who's now called Case C, and there's quite a long gap between Case C and Case B, and these are likely to be very low-paid workers, as you mentioned, Annabelle. In this case, employed by a private company, in this case, had not been vaccinated, had passed up two opportunities, reportedly for family reasons, had not been tested, it seems, for quite a while either. We also learned an example of what you were talking about, Ben, in terms of this kind of playing catch-up. Really what happened was now Chris Hipkins has said that all of the information about vaccinations, I think, will be supplied up the chain, whereas the private companies had it before, and it's kind of extraordinary. And it seems to me with the
he's called Case C because they don't have a list of all the frontline workers.
Well, I mean, there are all
Ministry
sorts
of Health desperately trying to find who this person is.
It's there's the devolved powers within to the DHBs from the ministry, and then there's also the use of contracted workers. And of course, we saw what happened in Melbourne. You know, this is not a Melbourne case, luckily. But what happened in Melbourne was there were private contractors that were employed by the state to do the security, and it all we know where that all ended. But just thinking about the vaccination program more broadly and the sort of certain amount of sluggishness, a certain amount of sort of nebulousness around it, and I think part of the, there isn't a public outcry in New Zealand, and part of that I think is because people mostly feel reasonably safe, and so you're not seeing what you're seeing in some other countries with the attention on it. But I was thinking about this, and I was thinking, you know, when we, way back, a year ago, really, when we were looking at the contact tracing systems, and there was a call by the Director General of Health, Ashley Bloomfield, for a gold standard contact tracing system. And Aisha Varel, who is now Cabinet Minister, was tasked with completing this report. And it was a pretty tough, blunt, clear challenge to sort some shit out, which they did. And I'm not some big city epidemiologist, but maybe we need a gold standard vaccination rollout, and I don't know if it's there. The stats aren't there.
I mean, we need a vaccination Google Docs. We need some way of keeping track.
I think, unfortunately, that's what Canterbury DHB were using. Isn't that part of the problem?
I mean, the idea that you would not know how many or who of your frontline workers had been vaccinated a month into the project is mind-boggling. It's almost as if, I just can't even think of an apt analogy. It's just, it's insane that we're still
this is
still
the first time on this podcast. I think we've been doing it for maybe 50 years now that Ben Thomas has not come to an analogy.
It is honestly incredible that at every point, you know, the government will tell us that, you know, something has been delivered, and then we find out that it hasn't been, that 13% of frontline workers haven't been vaccinated on the, you know, the tier one vaccination program, and they can't say why, and they don't know who, and it's honestly mind-boggling.
It's a shit show, but I think we can all take comfort in knowing that at least half of the Auckland DHB board's been vaccinated, so...
Okay, let's take...
Hopefully they can cut costs by holding their meetings at the Ibis in Hamilton.
let's do another 10-minute silence. We'll fast forward through again. Okay. The A story that broke yesterday was around some electoral donations, electoral finance, relating to the Māori Party and also to the National Party, which apparently been sitting on the Electoral Commission's website undetected since late last week. And the blogger No Right Turn surfaced them on social media. Anyway, as far as the Māori Party is concerned, that has been referred to the police, Annabelle, and it relates to $330,000 in donations.
$330,000. I'm just trying to bring up what they. How did they break down again?
Some was from John Tamihere, who of course was the co-leader.
$158,000.
$120,000 from Aotearoa Te Kahu, and $49,000 from the National Urban Māori Authority. You had the Māori Party President Shea Wilson on your program, The Hui, last night. How did he do, and how concerned are you about A, the non-declaration, and B, I guess, the sources of those donations?
He fronted on The Hui last night, and he did very well, and I think it's always good when, you know, when party presidents front foot these things. He said that when they realised the mistake, they referred it to the electoral office, the electoral commission themselves. He said that it was basically an administrative error, that the people taking care of it didn't realise what they needed to do, but as president, he took full responsibility. When he was asked about whether or not he was comfortable with receiving donations from NUMA, the National Urban Māori Authority, given its status as, you know, a whānau order, a grouping of whānau order providers and all of that sort of stuff, he said that that was a question for NUMA. So basically, as you say, two issues at play. One is the reporting of, you know, or the failure to report within the 10 working days. And the other one is the source of these donations. And I think there's a few people out there scratching their heads about how an organisation like NUMA can afford to make such generous donations to one party when essentially their core business is supporting vulnerable whānau.
Ready to rediscover the joys of cycling? With over 300 kilometres of cycle paths across Tāmaki Makaurau, jumping on your bike and going for a ride is such a fun way to discover the city from a different perspective. Cycling is getting more and more popular across Auckland, so now's a great time to join the hype and give cycling a go. Head to at.govt/cycling to find your nearest cycleway today.
Raising capital or taking your business to the world? Investment Fix has the lowdown on everything you need to make it happen. This season, we're exploring the US market, the opportunities it offers, what it takes to grow a business there, and the best way to approach investors. Join some of the superstars of the investment and business world as they share advice from their time in the US so you can make your mahi count in this massive market. The Investment Fix podcast, brought to you by Invest New Zealand. Tune in today.
Yeah, as a general rule, it's quote-unquote a bad look for not-for-profits who are funded by the government to fund political parties. You know, that's just a kind of baseline sort of shibboleth of politics. If they are going to donate, you know, you would donate across the spectrum to parties that, you know, had policies or values consonant with yours. So NUMA may have, you know, $5,000 to Labour, $5,000 to the Māori Party, $5,000 to the Greens, say. This follows, you know, a few questions during the Māori Party campaign about John Tamihere, who was co-leader at the time and it's probably its most prominent candidate, who has, you know, who is sort of knee-deep in all of this stuff. You know, he is the... Let me try and remember. He's the chief executive of Te Pō Matikana, which is the North Island Whanaora Commissioning Agency. He's the chair of the Waipareta Trust, which essentially distributes most of Te Pō Matikana's funding. And he was in the Māori Party, and all of these roles were. There's not a suggestion of impropriety, but there was certainly the possibility of blurring the public perception of which role he was in at any given point during the election. And once you start getting sort of money passing between these entities that, you know, he's got an association with, you know, questions will be asked, and they should be asked. And that doesn't necessarily imply there was any wrongdoing. It, you know, probably was just an administrative error. At the same time, I think that, you know, there is something a little disingenuous or at least jarring about saying we're just a small amateur grassroots organization, and that's why we didn't declare the $300,000 worth of corporate funding we received.
You've been in Parliament since 2005.
Well, I mean, there's also that other grassroots organization, the National Party, which is, hasn't been referred to the police still yet, could be it after it was, but was it Barfoot and Thompson?
New Zealand's largest bake stall collective, the National Party.
the donations which added up over time to the threshold for donations, so they're probably a collection of, you know, five times 1 hour's capital gain on a one bedroom in Avondale collected together.
Brick and tile.
So we'll wait to hear more about that.
And normally you'd say the Māori Party, no big problems here for the party secretary, because, you know, this sort of thing kind of tends to happen all the time. But
yeah,
police and the Serious Fraud Office have been much more active, and the Electoral Commission have been much more sort of aggressive on this stuff, probably dating back to the New Zealand First Foundation allegations a couple of years ago. So, you know,
it's just another example of why our election rules aren't doing what we expect them to do.
They're not gold standard either. Get Aisha Varela to have a look at that. We had one of the kind of jazz standards of New Zealand politics, which is leadership ructions in the National Party, stemming chiefly from a column that Claire Trevett, the outstanding Herald politics writer.
The respected deputy political editor.
Also the respected deputy political editor. The gold standard of deputy political editors, indeed. She wrote a column suggesting that there had been murmurings in the smoke-filled rooms of Wellington of a spill, as we are obliged to call it now, which would involve a leadership team of Lux and Bridges, and the idea was that Bridges would be a caretaker, which is, you know, a sort of a stretch to imagine, with Lux being kind of incubated like a good virus as deputy, only to explode in a super spreader event on the good people of New Zealand.
Is that really clear, though? I feel like we instigated that.
We did.
I feel like we did with
did
our
we?
Chris Luxon videos last week.
Oh,
I
yes.
feel like that we changed. Might like, be
Claire probably heard
for that.
The theme song.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
then was just, so that's the it. Future is Luxon.
That's it.
Yeah. That's what happened.
It was like, you know.
Could like be anything else.
You know, like when you have the summer and you can't like even walk down the street without hearing, you know, party rocker anthem or whatever, like outside, you know, from cars and things. Mm. Same with the Christopher Luxon theme song. You know, eventually the momentum just grows too great.
It's incredible. Earworm psyops underway by the Luxon sleeper cell, Ben Thomas. Duncan Garner was also kind of telling tales about what Simon Bridges had said to him off camera and all sorts of stuff this week. It's hard to suggest that it amounts to anything really, Ben, except it does show that there remains discontent and dissent and unhappiness in the National Caucus. It reminds me a lot of what happened in Labour over all those years. You know, you kind of...
If
they couldn't go 2 weeks without something
tell
else.
Tell us about your people, Ben. What's happening?
I'm going to National Party insider Annabelle Lee.
If you're a scholar of Dr. Seuss books like Simon okay. Bridges's. Keeping them archived in your bomb-proofed basement against the forces of political correctness, which will try and burn them, you'd be familiar with Yertle the Turtle, which is which is about a turtle called Yertle who proclaims himself king of all he can see in his pond. And then he clambers on top of another turtle, and then he can see further to the other side of the pond. And he's like, this is great. If I'm king of all I can see, all I need to do is, you know, get more turtles underneath me. And he piles them up. And eventually one poor put-upon turtle at the bottom gets sick of it and comes, you know, just leaves the pile. And then it all collapses, and Yertle is covered in, like, you know, pond weeds or whatever. And that, I think, it's meant to be a parable about, you know, don't get above your station, be nice to people on the way up, use your power wisely. But it's also a good parable about opposition in New Zealand, which is that any individual has the power to destroy. If you could analogize the National Party to a bunch of turtles all standing on each other's backs in a small country pond, which I think you can.
You can.
Either, you know, Christopher Luxon could remove his smooth body and head from the pile, and it could come crashing down. So Simon Bridges' attention could be distracted by a wokester frog on the other side of the pond, and he might set off after it, and the pile would again come crashing down. You know, you saw it with Jamie Lee Ross. One person has the capacity to make any kind of, you know, rumours about discontent or ructions a self-fulfilling reality in an opposition party. And, you know, I guess if you were left-wing, you'd call it accelerationist, where you sort of say, well, the party's doing badly, so we need to change the leader. And the fact that there's now leadership rumours means the party does even worse and brings you closer to a leadership change. Where I think the calculus is going wrong for people like, you know, Bridges and Luxon, if we can assume that they're behind these rumours, which I think, you know, I'm willing to go out on a limb and say they are, is...
But you don't know.
I don't know, no. And let's say their supporters. So their supporters, yeah. Luxon and Bridges' supporters, perhaps unknown to them completely. You know, normally when you do this sort of thing, you sort of think, well, you know, I'm safe because my electorate loves me. I'll survive whatever happens. I'll emerge from the rubble. I don't know that any National Party MPs can be guaranteed of that. You know, we saw at the last election, nobody's safe. they're all near extinction right now if they don't sort of get their acts together.
I think we all need a moment to just kind of breathe that in.
That was great.
That was a lot.
That was awesome.
Thanks, Ben.
Now the Lorax one.
We'll just go to another 10-minute silence. Before we go, let's talk...
How about 10-minute silence for free speech, Toby?
Let's do that. Well, let's do 20. The week began with a... What was it, an open letter, a petition?
Open,
you know,
letter.
Open letter. Love an open letter, don't you?
Yeah.
It's what gets you out of bed in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And it was from a range of groups, including Just Speak.
The Helen Clark Foundation.
Helen Clark Foundation.
Ben's favourite.
The Doctors One. The Doctors One. Was it the Health Professionals Association?
Oh, there's heaps.
But they were interesting because they had been a bit equivocal and weird in the lead up to the cannabis referendum. What I'm talking about is
a bit like Jacinda.
Cool. She did not sign the letter. They called for reform to the Misuse of Drugs Act, and it was met with a response from Andrew Little, who's not the Minister of Justice anymore.
But he's the Minister of Health.
If
you want to make drugs a health matter rather than a criminal matter, you're talking to the Minister of Health, which happens to be Andrew Little.
And he repeated kind of a position that he had intimated after the referendum had been completed, which was kind of, you know...
Wait, can I sum it up?
Yeah, go on.
Yeah, nah.
His position
basically
was,
his position.
His position was that the people had indicated that it wasn't the time to do anything really at all. Otherwise, the position from these groups and a large number of people is that it was a cigarette paper's difference, and so decriminalisation is on the table. There are still things in the Misuse of Drugs Act that seem pretty anachronistic. It's a weird kind of. You know, when was the misuse? When does it date from? The 60s?
70s.
70? A long time ago. A long time ago. And has had bits and pieces cobbled upon it into the state that it could do with the form. And, Bale, what did you make of all of that brouhaha?
I thought it was a real cop-out to reference the referendum and say that that was a reason why change couldn't be made. It was 50.7% of people, it's hardly an overwhelming mandate not to change. You could argue that that essentially the neutrality of it is a mandate to make change, but there's other options. It doesn't have to be legalisation, like you say. It could be decriminalisation, and to not do so while at the same time you have one of the members of your party exemplifying Chardonnay socialism at its worst with his private members' bill to make alcohol available on public holidays while Rome burns is really disappointing.
Well, I'm in favour.
Dr. Seuss?
I'm in favour of the alcohol available every day bill. Shout out to Kieran McNulty. Look, personally, I'm in favour of drug legalisation, pretty much all of it. At the same time, I can't help but feel the pro-legalisation, pro-decriminalisation voices are sort of being sore losers here. You can talk about the paper-thin majority. You can talk about it was 50-50. The referendum lost.
But it wasn't an endorsement of the status quo,
but the
was
thing
it?
Is well, that we're, not all legislation is created by referendum and...
No, there was a referendum.
There's people that are going to jail unnecessarily.
Yeah,
whose lives are being wasted, who are not getting a health response to their addiction issues but getting chucked in the slammer. Like, how can that be good for our country?
Well, it's probably not good for the country, as per my personal beliefs.
So it's not really about sore losers. It's about justice and an appropriate response to a significant health issue.
Yeah, but there seem to be a lot of people saying just ignore the referendum, or the referendum is actually a vote for change. It's not. The referendum lost. I mean, I think people have to be a bit realistic about that. You know, we're still in a democracy for whatever reasons. That was the vehicle for reform.
It's hardly an overwhelming mandate, Ben. It's 50. And the other thing is... Sometimes you've got to make hard decisions, and just because it's not the most popular thing in the moment doesn't mean that it's not the right decision to make. And 50.7%, it's literally a knife edge. And most of those people, the polls that they've done since show that they would actually support decriminalisation. So why would you not act?
Take another
well,
10 minutes.
Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern at her press conference, the National Party really needs to sort out its position on this, because progress may be impossible until their 25% of the vote starts to support legalisation. So, look, there will be reasons that they're not pursuing it, whether it's focus grouping or whatever. And, look, it's a shame, but...
It's a cop-out.
We're going to wrap it up. A big thank you to Jonathan for producing us, and thank you very much to Spinoff members for being the greatest. Join if you're not already. And we're going to go out with a shout out to Kiritapu Allen.
Yeah. Kia piki te ora, Kiritapu.
Hello for Lover. I'm Madeline Chapman, editor at The Spinoff. If you have the means, consider supporting our high-quality journalism by becoming a Spinoff member. Sign up now at thespinoff.co.nz/donate.
Kia ora e te iwi, Te Aihe Butler here, podcast manager at The Spinoff. If you enjoy listening to our podcasts, consider supporting our mahi by signing up to become a Spinoff member at thespinoff.co.nz/donate.
The Spinoff Podcast Network.